Samela Yanulotumlinsi. Samela.
Welcome to iMother Podcast.
Samela Yanulotumlinsi. Samela.
My name is Silja Nikolina Runestadter Kvalheim, and I am your host. iMother Podcast is a fellowship for and by women to share wisdom, experiences, and resources around birth and motherhood, and about resurrecting the soul after times of darkness. iMother is a term that derived in Sapmi, about traditional midwives and medicine women. A woman who could look into the souls of birthing women and hold space for her. She was a guide into the unknown in both birth as well as death, a priestess of transformations of the soul. I am a mother, birth worker, and light worker, and my sole work on this planet is to help women in and after birth to be wild and true and own their bodies and their stories. By sharing our wisdom and our stories, I believe we create a world for our children where women are supported, empowered, and held. In the background, you're hearing Mari Boina, together with Madosini. Welcome to iMother. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to a new episode of iMother. Today, we are continuing our deep dive into the broad and everlasting rivers of connecting with our ancestors. I am Silja, your host for this podcast, and today I will make sure to start a new tradition on this show, and that is to introduce myself and have my guests introduce themselves with where my people are from as a part of the intro. Thank you, Daniel, for that reminder. I am Silja, and I reside in the northern realms of Norway, Scandinavia. My recent ancestors are from Scandinavia and further back in time traveled north from Eastern and Southern Europe. Last episode, I shared a big story in my life about my late grandmother's interference in my life and a little bit about the healing that started for me after this realization. I then decided to apply for a scholarship to a course called Ancestral Lineage Healing by Daniel Fore at Ancestral Medicine. Getting there to send an application was an odd process for me. I felt very split in this choice, both an inner knowing that this is my path and also I don't want this to be my path. When I eventually had that clear to myself, I applied, and when I got the acceptance email, I knew from deep down in my heart and deep down in my belly and in my roots that this is it. The course and establishing connection with my ancestors and guides that are well have taken all my energy since the last episode. It has been a huge rearrangement of everything in my life, and especially that of energetical boundaries. My nervous system is slowly finding a new tone as I have found more clarity and more support from the dead. And so my late relatives are actually teaching me how to set boundaries in this life with the living. In this episode, we speak about connecting to our ancestors as well as the non-human world. We speak about human loneliness and energetical safety. We also tap into the topic of parenting and how we can be as mature and connected as parents as possible with the challenges life provides. And without further ado, here's Daniel's bio. Dr. Four lives with his wife, Sarah, and their two younger daughters in Western North Carolina, homeland of Cherokee peoples. He's a licensed psychotherapist, doctor of psychology, and the author of Ancestral Medicine, Rituals for Personal and Family Healing. He is an initiate in the Orisha tradition of Yoruba-speaking West Africa and has studied with teachers of Mahayana Buddhism, Islamic Sufism, and the older ways of his English and German ancestors. Daniel is passionate about training aspiring leaders and change makers in the intersection of cultural healing, animist ethics, and applied ritual arts. And he is currently enrolled in an immersive 2-year training in pandemic parenting. I hope this episode will inspire you, fuel you, and encourage your life journey and purpose, as this work has done for me. Enjoy. Hello, Daniel. Welcome to iMother.
Hello. Good to be here. Thank you.
Very happy to have you and excited to talk to you today.
Yeah, it's good to be here.
Maybe we can just start with a little intro of who you are.
Sure. My name is Daniel Four, and I'm descended from early English and German settler colonialist in North America, and I live now in Western North Carolina, traditional Cherokee lands, with my wife and our two young girls, and I am the founder of Ancestral Medicine as an organization that focuses on teaching animist and animist teachings, earth honoring teachings, ancestor reverence, reconnection, life skills in that way, focus on cultural healing. And in terms of my own background, real briefly, I'm a doctor of psychology and a marriage and family therapist, and been studying religion and spirituality for my whole life in different ways. And so it's been a passion and an area of focus. And I am basically like a professional ritualist. So I teach ritual skills and guide group process in that way. And a lot of it's online now because of the pandemic, but nonetheless. And yeah, not sure what else is helpful to say, but I'm a US citizen, so that's where I'm situated as well.
Thank you, Daniel. So before we get into the subject at hand, I asked you if you would be so kind to share a prayer for us.
Sure, I'm happy to do that. And can you help me to hear your name to make sure if I'm including you in the prayer that I'm saying it well?
Sure. Celia.
Celia?
Yeah, pretty good.
Okay. Great. We give thanks to the good earth and to the ancestors, those who support me, those who support Celia, and those who are connected to these lands and the lands where she is in Norway. And we ask that you help this to be a connective and useful conversation for the good of those listening. We ask that you help us to be guided and to bring through what is helpful for folks, and that the larger work of remembering our relatedness and living in ways that honor the children and life and the elders, that those ways return and are made accessible to everyone who is receptive as quickly and thoroughly as possible for the sake of the necessary changes on earth. And so may the conversation play out in that spirit. And thank you to the ones who support me in my life. Ashe.
Thank you, Daniel. It feels good. So I've been sitting in circle with you every other week now for couple of weeks at least, the course, ancestral healing has been going on for 4 weeks, I guess, something like that.
Yeah.
And it has been such a wonderful journey, and like nothing else, I have to say. So I just wanted to tap in a bit before we get into some questions. I just wanted to shortly share a bit about my story reaching to your work, which I shared also in the previous episode, but just to shortly, briefly explain a bit. So I became aware of having been a ghost receptacle, like you put it in one of your podcasts that I listened to. And that was so clearing for me to have that word for the first time in my life. I had always known that I grew up in like a ghosty house, and where people came in and out of the house regularly. So I grew up not really feeling safe at all, because I always felt these energies coming into my space. And after the death of my grandmother, as well as my father, the last 10 years, I've been in this kind of a state that I have just recently come out of. And it made me aware of what has been going on. And basically, my grandmother has been like totally in my space, in my life for the past 6-7 years. And I found that out the hard way, in the sense that I had a therapy session and we started working on this feeling of being feeling insecure, like feeling like a victim. And then I just sort of was guided to send her away into back into the light. And after that, my whole life has been like this avalanche of like puzzle pieces falling falling back in place, and that's where when I found your work, and I was sort of relentlessly and afraid started the course, but it's been such a tremendous help in boundaries and like really old childhood wounds that I've carried all my life. And then, like I share in the last episode, which is sort of like what we're gonna be talking about today, is how that affected my parenting and how this topic affects our parenting. And for me, it's been like this big topic of boundaries from when I became a mother. And just a reoccurring feeling of like being, oh my God, everything is just too close. And really, I have to say, for the first time in my life, I was sitting, now I'm working on the third lesson on your course. And I had a little ceremony yesterday to myself. And for the first time in my life, I sat with my guides across from me, and I felt safe. Like I had a feeling of having that ability to sense and be aware of the other side and actually feel held and safe. And that was so huge for me. And just thank you so much for that work. It's just amazing.
Yeah. Thanks. I mean, I can say a few things. Yeah.
Please.
And there's a lot of entry points to a discussion from what you shared in respect to the depth of work you're doing. A first thing that occurs is we have an illusion that we're supposed to know what's going on. And that we're just like, you're an adult now, so you should just kind of know what's going on. And what happens a lot of times, most of the time, is we're born into certain conditions. So it's all we know. It's our baseline. It's our frame of reference. It's the thing that our life is calibrated around. And so we don't have any context other than that context. And so when we come into a family, a pattern, a situation where boundaries are not necessarily respected. And that can happen on the outer physical level, but it can also happen on an energetic level. Mm-hmm. Like on outer level, there was no abuse per se, but if as a young person, you have disturbing spirit energies, ghosts, interference in your space, that's a different kind of boundary crossing mm-hmm. or a lack of safety. And it's just as real in a lot of ways. Mm. And so if that's all that we've known, then the idea that it could be something other than that is it's foreign. It's a totally new thing. And not to say this applies in your case necessarily, but I've guided thousands really of people through the work of ancestral reconnection since 2004 when I started doing that. And so I have a fair amount of data just to look at. And one common theme is people encountering real kindness for the first time. Mm. Like actually having someone who is their elder, who they don't have to take care of, because a lot of children end up trying to take care of their parents as a way of having some kind of control. And so having an elder that doesn't need taken care of by you, it actually sees you clearly and has good regard for you and wants you to be well. Mm. A lot of people haven't even encountered that. And so when that encounter happens, sometimes for the first time, whether you're in your 20s or your 50s or your 70s, and people encounter that for the first time, the safety, the feeling of actually being safe in an interaction at a deeper layer, a deeper level, is new, and it's disorienting and it's impactful. Like, whoa, I didn't know this was even possible. Mm. I haven't relaxed for the first 70 years of my life. I'm going to give it a try now. Yeah. And so that happens. It's never too late to have a good experience or an emotionally corrective experience in psychology jargon. And that it doesn't have to be with an incarnate human. It can be with the ancestors as well. Mm. And it doesn't have to be with someone who you knew during life. It doesn't have to be a recent family ancestor. We all have older ancestors who are quite healthy and well that can be accessed for support. That's very normal and it's very accessible to anybody. Mm. And another thing, the other thing I'd say in this moment, as we're just entering the conversation, is that if we are asked to hold others as a parent, we're being asked to be the stabilizing mother, father, regulating energy of the universe, to be the extended nervous system of the children. Mm. And when the child's freaking out, to not freak out back at them, but to actually like be the mountain and let the storm just move over. If we're being asked to do that, but we've never received it, that's possible, but that's a really big ask. Mm. They're like, here, now you parents are going to give something you never received. Mm. Go for it. Mm. In a larger culture that's tends to be fairly isolating and capitalistic and like already difficult in all kinds of ways. And so now you have to give more with less, and it's something you want that you've never had and no one's giving it to you, but you have to give it to others on very little sleep. Good luck.
Yeah.
Oh man. Thank God. That's rough. So I think it's doubly important for parents and caregivers of, you know, whatever sort, but I'll say parents here, to be able to access the experience of being held themselves.
Mm. Yeah, it's really the need to learn how to ask for support, I think, in these family structures that we live in, where community is not really happening, at least to ask for support.
And, a lot of times, at least just to speak from my own experience, and everybody's different, I didn't have a huge amount of trauma as a young person, fortunately, but no matter who we are, we still have needs, and it's normal and it's healthy and it's important that we have needs, right? Mm. like, I don't need a ton, but what I do need, I really need that. Yeah. And one of the things for me, at least, is I need to be seen accurately and understood. And I, and the way that somebody else gets held or gets supported is going to look different. Like, we have different ways of being met. Definitely. I don't need like a big hug. I need clear understanding. And for me, my ancestors can bring that. There are times in parenting or work where I will go to them and I'm like, I'm really struggling. Can you help me? Can I do, can any of these things come off of my plate? Is there any? And they're like, sorry, all those things are actually very important. What we can offer you is that we really see you. Like, we got you. We see what you're doing. You're doing a good job. That, like, we're, you're not alone in it. I'm like, okay, well, that helps. And so that sometimes just the being witnessed and understood by them is really important, and it's available.
Yeah, it's like cutting the umbilical cord to our like breath or the continuum of life, not having any relationship with our ancestors. It's a very odd way of relating to living. Really.
To what you were saying earlier, the way I view it, and I know it's a, I don't know, maybe it's a little direct or something. The way I view it is, people don't get to opt out of relationship with their ancestors. The settings of those relationships can either be conscious or unconscious. And so all the people not engaging in any way with conscious relationships with ancestors, ancestral influence, they're still just as much in relationship. It's just an unconscious one. And it means that it's more likely that your body is the altar. Like, you have no way to externalize the relationship. And so it's still happening unconsciously. And it means that all the stuff is going to play out through somatic, physical symptoms and experiences, through unconscious patterns, through, you're just going to recreate the patterns. They might be good patterns. If you happen to be down lineage from a lot of like love and creativity and wisdom and resilience, you might just have a really successful life and not ever stop to say, hey, thanks to my people for all the good momentum. But okay, that's just a politeness thing. No problem. You're having a good life. But a lot of times the patterns and the karma or the intergenerational like momentum is not so great. And then you just play it out, or you go to personal therapy and your therapist is like, oh, let's talk about that. Let's work on that. And that's good. But if you try to work on your problems as if they're your personal problems, your approach will not be as effective as if you frame them as intergenerational or bigger systemic problems. Most of the things we struggle with are like that. They're bigger patterns.
Yeah. Yeah, it just like fell into my head a couple of days ago, in regards to like, I don't know if it was something that you said, or there was just this feeling of, you know, if you're born into this life and you have these gifts and you have these abilities. And for me, that the sensitivity and the openness, you know, has always been my biggest challenge in life. And then it just dawned on me like a couple of weeks ago, like, holy shit, maybe that's why they've been totally up in my space, like to say like, listen, you're the one who need to correct this like boundary issue in your, you know, family lines, because if, and that's like the only way of getting your attention is like being inside of me more or less, you know, and at some time then you sort of just like need to get off of me kind of.
Yeah, I think that, I don't know if we consciously choose it before birth, or I don't know if it's like that or not. A lot of people view it that way, but whether or not it's like that, I think that a lot of folks who come to ancestral healing practices from a place of like, what is going on? I didn't ask for this, but it's a mess and I need to clean it up. There's a calling beneath that. Mm. And the ancestor, like ideally there's at least one person in every generation who is maintaining in any given family system, who's maintaining healthy relationships with between the living and the dead. I don't think it's something everybody has to focus on, but ideally somebody takes care of it a little bit so that it doesn't play out in an unconscious way. And the more sensitive people, the ones who are open, the ones who are getting ghosted by their, you know, their dead people, those ones are essentially having a calling to do the work. You may not want it. A lot of people don't want that calling. It's not convenient. Not what I mean, some people are into it because it's edgy and witchy and, you know, it's whatever. It's kind of fun in a way. But a lot of people are like, I wouldn't have chosen this. Why would I want this? Well, you can fight it. But look, a lot of our lives are dictated by necessity in our environment. And, you know, there's a war started this week. People in Ukraine, like, they're not like, hey, let's do some war. That'll be great. But it's what's happening. And so you, like, our lives in so many ways are shaped by the necessity that is all around us. A lot of people don't step into parenting in an intentional, deliberate way. But nonetheless, okay, you're having a baby. So you can fight it, or you can say, well, this is what is. And in the necessity, that's where our character really gets developed or not. If we can work with the conditions and not fight them so much that we don't even show up, but instead we say, well, these are the conditions. How do I work with it? And the response is sometimes like, I am overwhelmed. I am not able to work with these conditions. They are above my ability to deal with. So then we have to learn the really fundamental primary skill of asking for help. And it's the first skill we have when we come out of the womb, and is crying. It's like the ritual skill of crying, which is saying, help. I'm hungry, I'm cold, I'm uncomfortable, whatever. But that skill, it's in play for our whole life. It's the ability to call out for help, ancestors, help. I got a baby, I don't know what to do. I'm scared. I'm scared I'm going to mess it up. And they're like, yeah, you might. It's possible to mess that up. We'll help as much as we can, but yeah, you could mess it up.
Yeah, that just, the ritual of crying, that's a beautiful way to put it. Something so natural and human and just vulnerable.
It's where my teaching is headed. I'm excited for it, actually. It's a course that starts this, you know, next month. But what we're going to be looking at, and not in a self-promotional way, but the course is Initiations, A Life of Ritual. And what I'm excited about is, how do we learn ritual skills by looking at the different challenges at different stages of life and see what do we really need to be learning there? And so the first of those it is the like crying, invocation, calling out to the spirits, asking for help. Because if you can't make contact, your spiritual practice is not going to get off the ground. You're still just alone, which is okay. I mean, we're sacred beings. We're, you know, our own kind of center, but we're still alone. And then the second phase, like early childhood, the skill that I'm excited to teach about there is basically boundaries, like with ourselves and with others. I see it in our four-year-old. It's just navigating like how to say no to other people and how to accept when people say no to her. And, you know, growing up, it's like how to not be an asshole to people, like how to like ask for what you need, but also recognize when somebody says no. I know a lot of adults who don't have that skill dialed in yet.
Yeah, for sure. It's like a pandemic.
And the, yeah, and there's a lot of nations that don't have that skill dialed in yet. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
It's just that our lives will provide the necessity where we can either learn how to navigate stuff well or not. And I think that healthy culture, which, you know, I tend to look to indigenous wisdom and earth honoring traditions more broadly, whether or not they're indigenous per se, as a model, because those systems tend to be more relational generally. But when culture is working, there's an ability to use the moment in a pragmatic way of what's happening as the conditions in which to learn like essential skills. And you see like childhood in that way is like, it's an opportunity for parents to review whether or not we got those skills as well. Like, how do you navigate it when your child is hitting you in the face and you're tired? Do you freak out on them? Or do you like, do you let them hit you in the face? Or in between there, is there some really steady but challenging and patient way of saying, I'm not going to let you hit me in the face. I'm not going to react badly to you, but that's also not okay. And so we're going to work on this. I'm going to help you to regulate so that you can learn how to do this yourself and maybe even one day teach others.
Yeah, and that's just, that's it kind of thing. Like that's what we're doing when we're parenting. I had this beautiful moment with my daughter a couple of days ago because, yeah, in this process of boundaries and everything, my mother was also always crossing my boundaries, and that has been a really difficult pattern for me to break, and I've just sort of seen it happen. And but at the same time going into like this habit of when I'm tired and exhausted, I project and towards my daughter. And then I had this moment where I sort of put this whole puzzle and sort of integrated the feeling and what was going on and my own actual anger towards my mother being projected towards my daughter. And then I had this really wonderful moment where I invited my daughter in and asked her if she wanted to do this game together. And we put on, you know, air protection. And I was like, when I'm doing this like projection thing with you, explained in a kid's way, I'm crossing your boundaries, and that's really not okay. And I understand if you're angry with me, and then you need to, you know, direct your anger towards me because I'm the one who's doing something wrong. So now we're just going to stand here and we're going to scream, and you can just scream your lungs out towards me. And so we were screaming together, and she was so like embodied afterwards. She was so like whole, and like she came to me after we were crying, and she's like, "Mommy, I love you."
That's so good.
Yeah, it was like it resonated with her somehow.
This projection or seeing others only through the lens of ourselves, or putting aspects of ourselves onto others, it is a kind of energetic boundary crossing. Absolutely. And we do that, and kids do it with us, and it's totally normal, and they should, and it's part of their process. And if we haven't learned how to navigate that in ourselves, it's going to make us kind of crazy, and then we're struggling with them. But how many people really have someone talk to them about that, like you're doing with your young person, which is awesome, and educate them about that, mm-hmm. and validate the subtle energy reality of things?
Mm.
Not a lot.
Yeah, for sure.
It's our job as parents, and more generally as adults. So it's like, in that way, you know, I'm involved in Yoruba traditions, for example, and we'll even say in Nigeria, talking about our kids, it's omowa, as like our children, not just, it's not like your child, my child, it's our children. Mm. The sense is that we really hold the children as a communal responsibility, right? And so in that way, when I say parents, what I really mean is adults who have enough good sense to recognize we're all responsible for the kids. And so it's part of the responsibility of parents or care providers in general, not just to physically protect and provide for kids and emotionally be good to them, but to also ritually and energetically and spiritually, if you will, protect them.
Mm.
And when I say that, it for people already doing that, listening, they might be like, yeah, that's validating. I do that with my people or with my nieces or nephews or whoever, grandchildren. And for other people, it might be like, well, geez, how do I do that? I'm not sure how to do that. Mm. Nobody taught me how to do that. Well, yeah, no doubt. And so it's learnable. Those are learnable life skills of how to care for your own energy and environment and make sure you're not being eaten by ghosts, and then make sure your kids aren't being eaten by ghosts either.
Mm.
And it's not like if someone, a lot of kids have that experience where the troubled dad in the family, who those who haven't really left and they're not very at peace, will connect and be around the kids in an unhelpful way, in a way that can cause like health problems or just like unwellness.
Hmm.
And if it was a physical person in the house, it would be an emergency.
Yeah, right.
Because like, oh, there's a man in my daughter, there's a stranger in my daughter's room. You're like, well, that's an immediate emergency that needs dealt with.
Hmm.
But if we say, oh, it's a spirit in her room that's not safe. Well, that's also an emergency.
Hmm.
That also needs handled.
Hmm.
But we don't tend to live in a world where that is seen as real or legitimate.
Hmm.
And then so everybody has this whole private, spiritual, unseen aspect of their life that they don't even know how to talk about or deal with very easily.
Hmm. Do you think there is a relation? I mean, I'm sure there's a relation, but what are your thoughts about the relationship between the fact that we don't relate to the unseen and our, you know, state of affairs, let's say, you know, how disconnected or, yeah, like lost we are as a culture in a way?
Yeah, of course. It's hard to speak about that without also naming the confusion that not all, but a lot of humans have internalized, that we humans are somehow above or better than the other than humans.
Hmm.
And the trees or the waters or the spirits of the land or the deities or the stars and all that. When we think unconsciously that we're often unconsciously that we're better than others, that we're above them, or that we're the only clever ones or whatever. It's like saying, if I'm like, oh, only people that speak English are actually real.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a terribly arrogant and dysfunctional view. Nobody would usually say that out loud. But we do the same thing when we say only people who are human are really full people.
Mm.
And when we say that, or when we just operate from that assumption, then we're going to be really, really lonely and neurotic and unhappy. because some part of us knows it's not true and feels that it's not true.
Hmm.
And so then we act in ways that bring catastrophe to the earth. And that's what we're living through. And that's what I, you know, get to explain to our daughters when they get old enough. And that's what we're going to be living through for, even if things go really well, for at least another century or two. There's catastrophe ecologically.
Mm.
And that is, it's not an environmental problem. It's a cultural genocidal problem, because the other than humans also are culture and have culture. We're enacting cultural harm when we clear cut a forest or dam a river or cause other beings to become extinct, because they have their own language, their own song, their own communities, their own habits and ways and all that. And so when we unconsciously play out that harm and basically act like it isn't even happening, the part of our soul that knows better feels really freaked out or shut down, or like, this is really unsafe. Like the adults don't even know who they are. Yeah. And so our animal self is like, whoa, humans are dangerous. But then we're also human. So it's very confusing. Yeah. I mean, that can shift. I know that sounds rough, but that's the systems themselves are sometimes slow to change and are recreating this confusion moment to moment. And that's a lot of the stuckness that we're working with and will be working with for the next, you know, at least century, whatever it'll be. And it's very sad. And it's a challenging environment in which to raise kids and to have a spacious, joyful, playful life. It's very important to cultivate those qualities, to not just get in this like depressed, heavy, overwhelmed energy. But the sorrow that that follows from thinking we're alone or better than others, that's tearing apart the world. That is invoking catastrophe.
Yeah, I hear you. I just wanted to share in regards to that non-human relation, like I mentioned to you before we recorded, that I just came from riding a horse. And I used to like ride horses now and again, but then I stopped because I just couldn't bear the idea of sitting on, you know, horseback and not feeling connected with the horse, or having to strangle or be violent with the horse. So eventually I just stopped. I did a lot of like groundwork and danced with horses that were more like open and free. And then, I just stopped the whole connection of many reasons. But anyways, so today, or recently after I started your course, I've been dreaming about horses. And so I found a couple of horses that are close to me that I went to visit for a couple of times. And then today I was riding and I sat on the horseback, and I think I could have cried for two hours because sitting on, like, you're sitting on someone's back, you're not like walking next to them, or like you're in the horse's space. I mean, I am allowed to sit on his back, and I just can't. For me, it's like the ultimate image of trust, because I'm like sitting there and we're connecting, and he feels my signals and I feel his signals, but it's a huge horse. Like, it's a lot of power. And yeah, I'm just sitting on his back, you know. And it's just like, for me, horses have always been this like symbol of our culture, because horses are free spirits and they're wild and they have so much power, and we build most of our worlds, you know, on horsebacks. Like, we wouldn't have like railways or anything if it wasn't for the horse. And then what we do with the horse is to totally tame it, desensitizes and abuse it. And we don't even know it. Like, everyone does it. Everyone abuses horses. And it's just so sad. And then, but for me today, it was just like, wow, this like connection, you know, this relation, and like good boundaries, clear intent, good boundaries. It was just so like, I don't know, like very embodying and like transforming the wisdom that you have evoked, at least in me, into like this container of something really interesting.
That's great. I'm happy for you. It sounds connective and healing. One of the main courses, besides the ancestral healing course that we offer through ancestral medicine that I developed and guide, is a course called Practical Animism. And in that course, there's 12 lessons, but the one that is probably the most charged and the most intense for people is the one about food and about eating and how we kill others to eat. Even if you don't eat the bodies of animals, that you still kill plants and eat their bodies, and how intimate that is, and how uncomfortable it can feel to be the one holding the knife and the one taking life. And it's something I've learned about in my involvement with Yoruba traditions, where we sometimes pray with and kill and eat the bodies of animals as part of our ritual practices, whether it's pig or chicken or goat or whatever. So food is food. Yoruba people eat, and they eat animals sometimes, like almost everybody on earth sometimes eats animals. And I just happen to sometimes pray with them went in that process, which to me feels very healthy and connective. And then gets made into this very frightening, like animal sacrifice kind of, you know, or even racist, like scary thing. Right.
Yeah.
But when I watch people come into that tradition, for example, but whether or not it's animals, it can be plants, whatever. Sometimes people have this view of, oh, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I'm killing you. And I understand that there's a wisdom to it, but I think there is another wisdom that's something like, thank you for your life. And thank you for choosing, or thank you for this moment we're sharing. It's not like, oh, I'm sorry to burden you. I'm sorry to be this weight on your back, just the beautiful horse. But it's actually receiving the gift and being able to eat, to take, to receive. And does that come with an implicit responsibility to use your life well? So if you eat the body of a chicken or a pig or kale or whatever, does that come with the responsibility to then live your best life? Yeah, I think so. And yeah, there's something in there about not, like I don't prefer to do it, but if I'm traveling, I might eat fast food. I might eat low vibration food. I've eaten food that isn't organic. I've even eaten candy in my life. I know. It's like, oh, I thought you were so spiritual. And the in those moments, do I have this view of like, oh, I feel bad about this low vibration food. This is like unspiritual. Or can I actually look to the ones whose bodies that I'm eating and say acknowledgement to the corn, to the soybeans, to the potatoes, to the sugar cane, even to the chemicals, and that you're also part of the holy and the sacred. It affects how we see other people. Like, who are the people you most look down upon? You know, chances are it's people, if you're in Norway, that are, that have a really narrow, nationalist, judgmental view of other people. I'm sure there are people there, just like there are people here and everywhere. And they are usually the most annoying people for people who have a more progressive, international, or earth-centered view. And yet, the ability to love and be patient with people who are most annoying to us is that's part of another challenge of developing good character. Yeah, it's difficult, but there's the work. Righteousness is, it feels kind of good, but it leads to things like invading other countries.
Yeah. I just, again, like, see this link from speaking about the collective societal things, bringing it back to, like, our parenting, because that's more or less the same story, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was just thinking a bit about, if you could speak a little bit about codependency, because I think that's something that goes on quite a lot within a family structure or within our relationship to our children, maybe first and foremost, and how that relates to the dead.
Well, codependency can mean a lot of things, but the first thing that comes to mind is, if someone is embarking on the journey of being a parent, I think it's important that you have your own sense of soul level purpose and meaning and destiny that is not only defined by your job as a parent. Because if you don't already have a meaningful life in some way, it doesn't mean you have an outer job. It doesn't mean, it doesn't have to look any certain way. There's a risk that you will collapse your identity into the role of being the provider for that child only. And I'm not saying parenting isn't a huge and essential part of the identity of people doing that. It's a big part of my identity. I get that. But if you don't have your own sense of deep self-worth that isn't only that, what you can do is unconsciously, basically, you're saying, I'm the earth, I'm the God, I'm the provider, I'm the thing that sustains you. And therefore, you step in between the child and the divine directly. That you're trying to become the world for them. And it's not our job as parents to do that. That's when the kids are really young, there's a way in which we are anchoring that energy, but we want to move out of that and know how to move out of that as quickly as possible in a way that helps the child to regulate their nervous system in ways that don't rely on us. We have a second child, right? The older is 4, younger is 1, and the same birthday, so it's easy to remember. But we hold our younger child a lot less than we did our first one, which is great. She's doing so good, and she climbs on everything, and she's very healthy, and we've learned that it's actually that holding our older one as much as we did, and we still hold both of them, we're affectionate, we of course, you know, we love them and are affectionate, and that was more about us. And it was less about trusting that she could just play independently. I see a lot of parents interrupt independent play of children. When I'm like, what are you doing? You like the earth and the crayons and the, you know, the grass and the sky were regulating that child just fine.
Yeah.
your choice to intervene is about you. So if you could say, I just really need to hold my baby, okay, that's more honest at least. But if you say, this child really needs held by me, I don't know that they do. You are communicating to them that at any point you could step in and interrupt their direct communion with the earth because of your needs. I mean, that's a little heavy. Some people might just want to hold their baby and that's fine. But the first thing that comes to mind is really about being able to trust and help the child to learn to regulate their own nervous system and know when to step in. Mm-hmm. It happens with sleep, about like, how do we help them to have good sleep habits? You can't just immediately right away respond over the first year, 2 years, and expect that they're going to be able to get to sleep on their own. There needs to be a little bit of like exploration, and mm-hmm. there are different good ways to do it, of that range where they're learning to tolerate a little bit of discomfort. Because as adults, if we can't tolerate a little bit of discomfort, we're going to have a narrow life with a lot of addiction.
Yeah. I mean, I think like just to sort of clarify, at least for me, it's like one thing is the biological need for small children to be, to have their nervous systems, what's the word?
Regulated
yeah. by their parents when they're tiny. And then of course, it's this like, I mean, that's like one thing. And also it's the thing where we're not the only entity that can regulate eventually, right. and like evolving over time, there's definitely this natural instinctual way in children in which they ground through like focus or creativity or whatever is going on.
Yeah.
We in
teaching them how to call on the ancestors or the deities or the earth for mm. protection. Like, oh, you had a scary dream. Did you call on the ancestors? Mm. Oh, I did. Okay. Did that help? Okay. How do you know when they're here?
Yeah.
You know, our daughter, when I was she'll call on the ancestors. And as soon as she starts doing it, she gets annoyed with them because she says they're like, they're tapping on her chest, like they're knocking. Like she's like, they're too forceful. And I'm like, well, tell them to be more gentle. She's like, okay, now they're okay. But she's like, hey, you got to come like quietly and, you know, get it this part of the room and stand outside the room. And she'll kind of like tell them what they need to do. Mm. I'm like, that's fine. You can push back and explain to them. But the kids ideally see that adults recognize that they need to regulate with the powers too. Mm. Like being in, I've seen it in Native North American ceremonial spaces as well, but even more in my own life experience in Nigeria, being in community and the adults, including the straight adult men, invoking the earth or the goddesses and the deities with the kids around and the elders around, because that's just what adults do, is you ritually feed the gods and you pray to the mothers that hold up life and you make offerings to them and then you have dinner and that's just a regular day. And that modeling for kids, that it's normal to pray out loud, it's normal to have needs, it's normal as an adult to recognize that you need to let other bigger powers hold you, that makes it okay for them to do that themselves.
Yeah, I'm just like, when you're speaking about that and also from the last few months of experiencing with or experimenting with boundaries with the unseen, I'm just a bit amazed on how like very clearly that affects my ability to set boundaries in my waking life. And sure. I'm curious if it's like, because that was like my primal wound, let's say, you know, because yeah, I had an issue with the, yeah, feeling overwhelmed by energies. But also I'm like, is that actually more normal? Like, is it more normal to learn it that way, kind of?
Sure. From a psychology perspective, the other than humans, whoever they are, sometimes we can see them, sometimes we can't. If you see a bear, it's like, oh no, that's visible, you know, pay attention. They're just people, right? They're just other kinds of people. And what that means psychologically is we're going to have projection and fear and confusion and intimacy and all kinds of feelings, because they're just relationships. And the good thing about that is that when we learn something in one place, it can transfer into other places.
Yeah.
I think that's true. And I think it is often the case that we learn it in one area and then it transfers. It's one of the ways that healthy earth-honoring cultures, indigenous or not, teach good values. Is maybe there's a ritual to honor the returning salmon, or a ceremony for the first strawberries, let's say, or the first berries. And you give the first berries to the deities or back to the earth, or you don't just run out and drop them in your face. You know, you slow down and so you're not greedy with it. And that same etiquette between the human and the berry people, or the human and the salmons, the salmon then informs how you approach something like sex, where you, consent might be important. It might be important to be attentive to who you're with and not just take what you want.
Mm.
And so those same values that we were talking about earlier about respecting your own boundaries and others' boundaries, those get modeled over and over and over in ritual space with the deities and with the other than human powers. And so it is true, I think, that how we do relationship anywhere is how we're going to do it everywhere. We tend to operate from the same maps of relationship, no matter who we're relating with, usually.
Hmm.
So if we shift it in one place, it can shift in another place. I do think that's true. Yeah,
and I think also, like, when you're setting boundaries towards something that you don't see but you feel or sense or whatever, it also demands of you that you are even more clear, like that you become even more aware and like embodied and clear about what you are actually sensing compared to having like a brown bear come up towards you howling. And then obviously, you know, so it's like, yeah, you need to trust yourself even more somehow.
It's also, I don't know if it's as bad there, but in the United States, at least there's because of the developmental stage of the nation as a whole, generalizing here, of course, but I think nations have their like specific kind of trauma. And because of the big trauma that is like this dust over this country here in the US, it means that a lot of folks operate from a very binary mindset, from a very black and white, either or mindset. And so it's like either yes or no around boundaries. I need to say yes to it or no to it. Well, it's actually okay to say slower. I'm not sure. And I feel confused. I'm not saying no, I'm not saying yes. I just need it to move slower. I'm not sure yet. And you know, you could apply that to, you know, sex or something around consent, but it applies to every other kind of interaction in life, that it's okay if someone asks you to like attend something or do an interview or do a training or, you know, to participate in something, you don't have to know what the answer is right away. It's okay to say, I'm actually not sure. And it's okay in parenting to, I mean, it happens every day. Like our child did not get enough blueberries before bed last night. And then she was in bed and she's like, I'm so hangry. I need more blueberries. And I'm like, if I do this, it's going to happen tomorrow and the next day and the next day. And internally, I'm like, she's winning. I'm considering it. I'm like, no, don't do it. And that she's genuinely hungry. And internally, I'm like, this is confusing. I want to just give her blueberries and have everybody go to bed. But if I do that, I'm going to pay for it later. And so you know, there's a need to be consistent with, you know, when we can with boundaries. But mostly what I'm meaning to say there is, like, it's messy a little to actually learn. Like, it's not like, oh, I'm going to have clear boundaries now and it's all really crisp and obvious what to do.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's not how it goes ever. Mm.
Yeah, you don't get like a set of a blueprint ready when you're born and like, this is what you're going to say no to, this is what you can say yes to, and this is a maybe. Yeah, so
right.
Moving and shifting. And yeah, that's why we parent and try our best. And yeah, that's how we evolve as humans, I think, or at least.
Well, something that's super clear with little kids is younger kids is they just don't have the same conception of time developed. So one of the ways as parents, we need to hold the longer sense of time, because even if your child is really bright and really doing great, And they're like 4 years old, when they're upset, they're like, this is the worst thing forever. And it's always going to be so bad forever. And you know, they're wrong, but it's their experience. And so it means being able to operate from this different sense of time. That's obvious maybe, but it's one of the ways that there really is a power differential. And it's hard because it means being able to deny ourselves what we want to do. Like, I didn't give her the blueberries last night. I did on a different night. And that's why we were having the problem.
Yeah, right.
and she even said it last. She's even like, but you gave them to me last week. Yeah. I'm like, oh, I did. I shouldn't have.
Yeah. Yeah. Input of timelessness with the children I guess invited me into being more flexible or having more of like a spaciousness that I can feel when I'm doing the work of, you know, reconnecting ancestry and like this whole non-human world where this is more like allowed or like
from the ancestors' point of view, we adults are like the four-year-olds because they have a much longer view of time than we do. And we're just like, we're freaking out, the earth is dying, or all my, you know, whatever we're freaking out about there, or you know, or I'm having such a hard year or month, and they're like, oh honey, I know we have the 5,000 year view, but I recognize you're having a hard month. I'm sorry, that's hard. Let me just hold you. And they're like, but my child is having a meltdown and they're having a really hard 10 minutes and I'm having a hard month. And they're like, well, we're having a hard 2,000 years, but we let the earth hold us.
Yeah.
And the stones are like, oh yeah, the sun's going to swallow us, but the humans are all freaking out. And so, so everybody's holding everybody else, hopefully, if it works.
I'm just, before we round up, Daniel, I'm just sort of tempted to ask you one question before sharing a bit about how we can find you. And that is, how do you feel about dying?
It's fine. I don't want to anytime soon. I like being here. It takes a lot to get acquainted. I mean, you have to go through all kinds of bullshit just to have a childhood and everything. So I don't want to die soon, but it's fine. It'll happen. I think it's, I like being alive. That's my first just response. Mm-hmm. In the course I was mentioning about the stages of life and all that, one of the ritual skills that I think is important to cultivate before your physical death, besides facing what repairs you need to make from your life, which is important, it's kind of making amends or like getting ready to die, which you could do at any time, is helpful, is actually the kind of ego death that can occur before the death of the body. Because you can physically die, but not actually go through any of the ego identity death that needs to happen. And you can go through the real death of the illusion that you exist as a separate thing before your physical death. And so in some ways that death is more real. The death of the body is, well, that's just a change of clothes a little. I mean, that'll happen, and when it happens, and we can control it a little bit, but not too much. And so the more interesting death is the direct experience that there's nothing separate or separable, like that we're, well, you know, it's the stuff people talk about with enlightenment, and which is not, you're not supposed to talk about it in that way, I suppose, but the direct understanding that we're all made of the same fundamental mystery. Mm. And that that's desirable. That's good. That's something to attempt to call in to our lives. It doesn't make the conditions different. It doesn't mean that, you know, the Russian government won't invade necessarily. It doesn't like insulate us from suffering, but it will help our soul to stay intact through the hardships that come. If we understand that there's some aspect of what we are that is still settled, never been harmed, is like never going to die, has never been born, and has this kind of luminous ancient stability. Mm. If even some of that can break through and like percolate up through our sense of identity, it's good. It makes our days a little easier and a little, it's easier to keep perspective, and it's easier to access kindness, which is kind of what holds the world together. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Daniel. There was an image that came up for me when you said that ancient stability. I just saw this pyramid, you know, and how when we move up, like when we move up higher on the pyramid, we come closer. And the closeness is actually what elevates us, the connectedness and the, our connectedness with everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have to find that in the very specific conditions of our specific life.
Hmm.
It's not going to happen anywhere else.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Thanks, Daniel. So before we finish, where can people find you? And is there anything that you're up to that you are wanting to share a bit about?
There is, naturally. All the info about what I'm up to is at ancestralmedicine.org. And I'm excited. A lot of what we do is the ancestral earth reconnection. So we have courses in ancestral healing and animist ethics and ritual. And I train folks, our team trains folks in how to guide ancestral healing practices. And there is a growing network of, you know, about 150 folks around the world from 20 plus countries learning those practices, which is heartening. And the new exciting thing that I would name here is the teachings that I'm guiding now in animist or earth-honoring parenting and lifespan, like rituals over the lifespan, as I was mentioning. And so the initiations and life of ritual course will be opening, I guess it's the start of May. And that's a year-long journey, which I'm excited to have more of a dedicated working group of people over the year to learn how, considering the lessons that arise over the course of a life, is one lens through which we can reclaim ritual skills. So I guess I would, the last thing I'd say is what I'm up to, even though I have a, I'm sort of, I suppose, a philosopher or some kind of, I'm interested in the bigger picture things. At the end of the day, I'm also a ritualist, and I'm interested in how we can learn the actual skills and practices to enact relational values and how that can be really normal and really mainstream and really accessible to people of different cultural backgrounds and really, common, and how we raise kids, how we do family, all of it. So yeah, lots of resources for that at the site. And I super appreciate the work you're doing. Thank you for your service. And it's good to be part of the conversation today. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Daniel, and good luck with your course and your upcoming visions. And thank you so much for your work.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Daniel, for your time and your insight and your work. You can find more info about Daniel and his work at ancestralmedicine.org. Please do check out his work. This site is filled with resources and free offerings. I have enjoyed Daniel's way of teaching so much. I find his presence so clear, precise, and warm. I'm so grateful for having this work been shown to me. And I do have some exciting news that I want to share with everyone. I will be offering, together with me, Scott, whom you met in episode 23 about aware parenting, a two-part retreat in Hurdal from the 30th of June to the 3rd of July this year and the 27th to the 30th of October. This retreat will be for moms, and it will be based upon the topics of mother-centered community living that I offered online last year and in the beginning of this year. If you participated in this course, you can attend again, as it will be very different. Much more experiential, community deepening, and embodying. I will post more info about this in the next couple of weeks, so make sure to check my website as well as me's website and Facebook page for more info. We hope to create a nourishing, moving, and inspiring sister retreat for you ladies, so do join if you feel the calling. Sending you listeners lots of love and support. Thank you for listening, and thank you for being you. I hope this upcoming spring will be exactly what you need in your life. With love and deep respect, I am off to hang with my new four-legged friends. I'll see you soon.